And would you turn back to the passage that Tim read for us, to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. If you've got one of the Pew Bibles, you'll find it's on page 159 of the New Testament sections. In case you weren't with us last week, I just want to remind you of the background to Paul's teaching to these Christians and to the scene they were facing in Corinth. Corinth, you remember, was a seaport, and we said it had all the vices of a seaport, and immorality was rife. It was a kind of sex-mad world. I was reading about one American pastor who used, whenever he was teaching from these books to his congregation, he used to call them 1 and 2 Californians, because he said that the situations were so similar. And then I've discovered in the last week that, of course, even that isn't going to earth it properly for us. Because again and again, I mean, just this week, of course, I suppose once you find yourself in a subject, it always crops up. I see how relevant it is even to us in Britain today. California always seems way out and weird, doesn't it? But I have heard in the last 7 days of miles from here, Christian Union leaders, boy and a girl living together and seeing absolutely nothing wrong in it. I met a vicar who said to me that in his time he thought he'd come across in his church everything written of in the letters to the Corinthians apart from incest. Well, I've found that. Heard of a student sharing a room in a hostel who woke up one morning to find two people in the bed opposite. Well, there's nothing particularly unusual about that in one sense, except that that's just the situation they're having to face. I heard about a leaflet entitled Sex, which ran like this: "Bet you love it, is what keeps us together, it's good for you." And there's nothing wrong in all those statements, as we'll see tonight. But this happened to be talking about homosexuality. And it was on sale, according to reliable sources, in a church near here, recommended by an organization listed in the Church of England yearbook. You see, the world had got into the church in Corinth. We saw that last week. But it's not greatly different today, is it? Now, I want you to bear that background in mind as we come to study this chapter. Not because it should mean that we must find different conclusions. Actually, we're forced to face the teaching all the more, aren't we? Because we can't say that things have changed much. I want you to bear the background in mind, because we're leaving what I probably rather tastelessly described as raw sex last week, and we're moving on to the slightly more sensitive areas of relationships and marriage and singleness. And I want to say from the outset that I'm very aware of the minefield I'm tripping over this evening. It's been my prayer all week that I might be very sensitive as I do it and yet be faithful to the truth in this chapter. So please, I ask you to listen with those ears. That's what I'm trying to do. I do want, as last week, our text to set the agenda for us. There's not going to be time to cover all of 1 Corinthians 7, and it doesn't start where many of you are starting necessarily when I say married or single. You see, the issue is one of sexual purity, isn't it? Look at how Paul introduces the subject in verse 1. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote," he's going to come on to answer some of their particular queries. Now, unfortunately, unless you happen to want to do a PhD on this thesis, in which case it's very fortunately, we don't have their letter, so we don't know exactly what it was that they wrote about. That's why you can get PhDs guessing. But the subject doesn't seem to have changed a great deal from the previous chapter, and it must be somewhere in this area of sexual purity and how I cope. I want to say that because I want to say again, this is not a marriage treatise, this chapter. The scholars are incredibly thick at times when they read this chapter and pick out verses and say what an appallingly low view of marriage Paul had. He's not setting out to tell us what marriage is about and what it's really all like. He's toping with the area of sexual purity. If you want to know his high view of marriage, read somewhere where he is doing that. Read Ephesians 5. And he's not therefore primarily setting out to talk about singleness and all its ramifications. Though you won't be able to get much more positive than this chapter. Just want to say again, I may not be touching the issue that springs instantly to your mind when we cover the areas. I mean, I know if I talk about married and single, I'm talking about everyone in the church, aren't I? It's one of those nice, easy subjects. But it's a very sensitive area. Forgive me, it may well mean there are lots of questions you've got that won't come up tonight. Well, do get one of the books and read them. Do talk with someone about it. Someone suggested that I ought to say if you want to just kind of come and talk in a group about some of the areas, I'd be in the basement afterwards, but that sounds a sort of sleazy place to be. So I'll be in the room downstairs about 1/4 hour after the end of the service, and I'm quite happy to at least listen and see what we can do with discussion and questions. But don't forget the issue then. The issue is sexual purity. So now let's look at the principle. And you might entitle this is verses 1 and 2, Two Ways to Cope. With apologies to a certain leaflet. And I think that there's a slightly artificial divide in the verses in 1 and 2. It seems to me that the second half of verse 1 and verse 2 go together. They set the principle that keeps repeating itself through the chapter. Listen to what the apostle says. It's well for a man not to touch a woman, but because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Please, Mr. Apostle, you know the scene we're living in and we're having to cope with. How do we cope? Well, there are two possibilities, he says. One, verse 1, celibacy. Don't touch a woman. Now, touch isn't to be taken literally, though there's often something of that feel in the attitude of those who follow this course. It's really talking, I suppose, about the physical act of sex. And he says if that's the course someone's going down, it's well. Not necessarily morally good in the sense of better than anything else. Certainly not exclusively so, but it's fine. That's fine, he says. Now please, if this seems strange approach to you, because obviously the world at the moment heads the other way, do what you like, let me just explain the thinking behind it. I think very often when it comes up, and it frequently does, in Christian circles reacting against the scene around them, there is at heart a real desire for holiness. Sometimes, maybe often as well, a real sense of the person's own weakness. And look, the safest course for me is just to steer right clear of this area as best I can. I've set myself, therefore, on a course of celibacy. No sex, please, we're Christian. That's what it's saying. And I do want to urge you to go home and read through this whole of this chapter and notice how Paul handles people. I think he's got this kind of person in mind very much as he writes here. And I think as you read the chapter, you'll agree with me that he makes a very determined effort not to undermine the position of the single, sexually self-controlled person. Goes out of his way not to undermine their position. We need to be careful we don't. Let's understand that sometimes some of us have got a social shyness and awkwardness that it's easy to mock, but if we mock someone out of it, it's actually removing our greatest defense to an area where we feel we're not sure we can cope. Do be gentle. But if this person is going to take this attitude of celibacy and start imposing it as rules, if they're going to suggest that this is how we should all be, or more insidiously, and this is actually how it comes out more often, if the implication is, listen, if you want to be really spiritual, if you want to be really keen, if you want to be really holy, if you want to be really zealous, then you'll never touch a woman. Well, the apostle steps in quickly. Well, still, if this Christian has blinded himself or herself into thinking that the only way to be holy is this one, even though there's this dishy girl, hunky fella, whom I love, like, respect, admire, whatever it is, waiting there, but I want to stay pure, so I'll do nothing about him or her. Then the apostle instantly says, doesn't he, listen, there is more than one way to cope. It's well, it's fine for a man not to touch a woman. But there is another way, verse 2, and it's called marriage. And there's nothing immoral in marriage, he's saying, and there's nothing unspiritual in it. Come to think of it, God invented it. Someone once paraphrased verse 2 and said this, Christians say that a man should have only one wife. It's called monotony. Well, just because they couldn't spell doesn't mean to say they've got it wrong. Well, no, not the monotony bit they've got wrong, but the rest is right, isn't it? Marriage is good for you too, is what the apostle's saying. You can go the celibate path. You can say no sex, please, we're Christian, but you mustn't forget there's the other alternative. Marriage is good for you as well. There are two ways to cope. Now, there's more than one, but I want to say this. There isn't more than two. Let me just go back a moment to what we were looking at last week, because I found this argument thrown at me when I was a student, not at a theological college. I've heard it many times since. I was told that when the apostle writes of immorality back in chapter 6, he uses a Greek word, porneia, from which we get pornography. He's speaking only of prostitution, or at best promiscuity. He's not thinking about the faithful, loving relationship I might have with someone else, even though I'm not married to them. Well, of course, when they start telling you the Greek word does or doesn't mean something, it baffles me, and I guess it baffles most of us. But it seems to me the clearest answer to that comes when you start reading chapter 7. It envisages some extraordinarily close relationships, and yet it constantly gives us only two ways of coping with the situation without being immoral, either celibacy or marriage. It's absolutely clear that the traditional interpretation of immorality is precisely what the apostle had in mind when he was writing to the Corinthians. There are two ways of coping. There's the principle. The issue, sexual purity. The principle. Two ways to cope. Now, one application. Here's verses 3-6. And if you wanted me to sum it up, I would say this. Marriage is for sex. No, it's for other things as well, but marriage is for sex. Not the other way around. Well, the other way around is true too, isn't it? Sex is for marriage, but marriage is for sex, seems to be what he's saying in verses 3-6. Let me explain. You see, we are sexual people. That's not Freud. The Bible discovered that a long time before Freud ever came on the scene. That's absolutely true, isn't it? See, why is it that when the subject is sex, it's the one time preachers aren't struggling to be relevant? We know for sure we're on a winner, that everyone will actually listen, at least for the first 10 minutes, because sex is a subject that's close to all our hearts. God made me with sexual drive and energy and attractions, and he made you the same way. Now, if celibacy was the only route, then we're actually saying something terrible about God, aren't we? We're saying he gave me all those powerful things and no means of the ultimate expression of them. But of course, it's not true that celibacy is the only route. Marriage is the place of expression. And what Paul is saying here is, you ought to express it there. It's actually very radical teaching. Look at verses 3 and 4. the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Why? Well, because the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. You see how radical that is, don't you? I mean, forgive me for caricaturing a moment, but the male chauvinist pig says, my body is my own, I'll do what I like with it when I like. And the feminist says, I demand equal rights, my body is my own. And the apostle says, neither of your bodies are your own. If you're married, why, at the heart of marriage is the principle of self-giving. You see, the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. And so he goes on in verses 5 and 6. And this perhaps is surprising teaching to some of us. See, don't refuse one another, except perhaps by agreement for a season that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, lest Satan tempt you through lack of self-control. Not even mutual denial is recommended. What's the point, says the apostle, of entering such a bond and commitment to one another and then not expressing it? You might as well not get married at all. Spiritual marriages. You know, you hear about them occasionally in some of the cults and the sects. And just on the fringes of Christian churches, you know, we'll do the spiritual thing. We'll be joined together, but, you know, we won't actually be physically intimate. They're out. Sex isn't a dirty thing. It's not as if the moment the husband and wife come together for sex, somehow or other you've just got to kind of keep God out of that bit, you know, and hope he's looking the other way. It's unspiritual, that time. That much overworked phrase, just good friends, which is rarely true, is not for marriage. See, it's quite dramatic what he's saying, isn't it? When Claire and I got married, a number of good Christian friends came and gave us that bit of advice, that little bit of doggerel that good Christian friends are always giving you when you get married. The couple who pray together, stay together. And I'm sure the apostle would accept the truth of it. But it's quite interesting that what he's saying here, what he's suggesting here, is something that very few of my Christian friends say. Something much more like this, if you want to put it in doggerel terms. The couple who sleep together, keep together. But that's it, isn't it? He says, to be very careful about this idea, even mutual agreement of giving it amiss. Lest Satan tempt you through lack of self-control. See, isn't it unusually balanced teaching? We saw last week that our discipleship means we give our bodies to the Lord, so when it comes to marriage, which he explains elsewhere as the prime model of the Christian's relationship to Christ, I'm not surprised to discover we give our bodies to one another. Isn't it wise teaching? Gives the lie to the idea that once married, there's no more sexual temptation and you're bound to have got immorality cracked. There is danger. Satan is still looking to tempt us, even in this area. The roving eye has not been stilled and fixed. So give yourselves a full sex life, he says, if you're married. And I take it that verse 6 is meant to go with verse 5. There are a number of possible interpretations as to what he means by the this. I can't think by the this he's talking about getting back together again. That can't be his concession. It goes against all he's just been saying, doesn't it? I don't think really that the this means the whole idea of marriage. Seems to me that's contrary to the balance he's got in the chapter. I suggest that it makes most sense and it's most consistent if by this he means the idea of refusing one another for a season. Even this idea that you might just occasionally, just for a short while, just so that you've got time to pray, give sex amiss, I'm only saying that as a concession. It's not a demand. Don't feel you've all got to. the issue, sexual purity. The principle? Two ways of coping. Celibacy or marriage. An application? Marriage is for sex. Don't miss out. The summary. Don't be fooled, the summary is quite the longest point. Well, you know, I don't want to raise hopes. Verses 7 to 9. God's special gifts. This is just another way of allowing me to restate the principle. But it seems to me it's what the apostle does. You see, I think, again, the paragraph division is bad, and verse 7 would be much better off with verses 8 and 9. He begins by saying this, "I wish that all were as I myself am." And he's writing, it's clear from the next verse, as a single person. Now, I suspect that as Paul writes, he's writing particularly in view of what he's about to say, and he's about to say a lot about singleness, that he's speaking from the ideal position. Though he's single now, it's highly unlikely that the Apostle Paul was not married once. It was traditional for the Jews of the day to be married by something like the time they were 18. Certainly for the Pharisees in the position that Paul found himself, they were almost always married. If, as there seems good reason for supposing, he was a member of the Sanhedrin, he would have had to be married, because they thought married men were more merciful. So it is most probable that his wife has either died or separated from him when he became a Christian. Either way, if that's the case, he's speaking from the ideal position as he talks about singleness and marriage. You see, he knows both sides of the fence. He knows what he's talking about. And yet now he's faced and is speaking from what most people would consider the tougher option. Being single. I know I don't speak, if that was his position, from exactly the same place. Because I know this is hitting a sensitive area, let me say that being a married man, I am one of those who knows what it's like on both sides of the fence. That's true to all of us who are married. Actually, as I look around, I guess that I've been single for longer than many of you. I had seen the back of 30 before I was married. I'm conscious that some of the things I say won't be the things we'd most like to be reading about and hearing. I know I'm treading on delicate ground. So let me try and let the apostle do the speaking. "I wish that all were as I myself am," he says. Paul, you see, is writing very contented as he is. It's obvious through this chapter that the man has found that being single suits him well. He can cope with it. But, you see, don't let's ever take one of his sentences in this chapter and assume that the next one isn't there. But, for all his good reasons, he knows that we're made different, and he knows that it's not God's way that we should all be like he is. "I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own special gift from God." One of one kind, one of another. Each has his own charisma, that's the Greek word. Each has his own charismatic gift. By the way, that might sort of lengthen your list a little bit. And if you kind of, whenever the subject comes up, you always feel, "Oh, but I don't have any gifts." Isn't this good news for you? You've got one of these. All of you. It's nice to be able to make a start, isn't it? So he says, look, singleness is a charismatic gift from God. And there's someone who's sitting there saying, "Well, that's one present I could do without." Well, fair enough, I understand, please. But just wait a moment. Just let's explain clearly what he seems to be saying about this gift of singleness. See, remember, he knows perfectly well that God made me a sexual being. Now, celibacy is fine, he says, verse 8, to the unmarried and the widows. That's what I mean by singleness. People in that bracket. I say that it's well, it's fine for them to remain single as I am. But because we're sexual beings and we're made that way, the apostle knows perfectly well that to choose that route means that I set up inevitably tensions. I've got to cope with my drive, my urge, my desire, my attractions, and yet I've decided not to go the whole way down there. Oh, we'll know it. We probably all know it, you know. It feels, doesn't it, as if the feelings have been building up over days or weeks or months or whatever it is, and I've got to do something or I'll explode. It's not like that, but it feels like that, isn't it? I won't actually explode, but it certainly feels as if I will. Well, he says, look, if I can't handle it, there's nothing wrong about being married. It's not a failure if I get married. That's a gift too. That's what he's saying in verse 9, isn't it? If they can't exercise self-control, they should marry. It's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. Much better to be married than immoral. Much better to be married than to go through life with your tongue hanging out. You see, the gift of being single, it's not as if the kind of label single has been kind of stamped on you somewhere or other, and all the rest of us have spotted it, and that's why we're not asking you out. Isn't the gift, as he seems to be talking about it here, the ability to cope? Well, my friends, if you're single, that's actually quite good news, isn't it? Oh, you say, hang on, I'm still not sure I'd like to have a gift of the ability to cope. Why couldn't I be one of those who can't cope? Then I could get married. Yes, but to whom? You see, what if the only opportunity you've ever had is to that person who was such a wimp or a wallflower? You decided better the tensions of celibacy than the tensions of living with him or her. That's realistic, isn't it? I mean, the fact is, someone tells me who works out these statistics, that a third of the country at the moment is single. Now, they are either not married yet, or they never will be, or they have been and aren't anymore. I think that covers all the options. And if that's the case, and if it's true as it is, that some will remain single for life, isn't it great to know there is a gift of coping? Now, don't misunderstand me. The gifts of marriage, and it's just as much a gift. But I think the apostle expects us to realize they're obvious. That's why I'm not sure that they get the same stress in this chapter as what he's got to say about singleness. He's talked about one of them, the whole area of sexual purity and sexual enjoyment. And the end of frustration. And others are obvious too, aren't they? All the things that the sex act, so to speak, is representative of. Companionship and intimacy, support, comfort, help. It is a great help to living Christianly, to having a godly wife or husband. But the apostle says there is another side of the coin. There's a gift about being single. He comes back to it and spells it out a little more, I suspect, towards the end of the chapter, in verses 32 to 35, where he's writing about wanting people to be free from anxieties. We'll come and look at it in more detail, but I just want us to realize that that's true. There are two sides of the coin. We actually know about it, don't we? I mean, if I'm single, sure, I long to be married at times. I take it most people when they're single do. I certainly did, long before I was married. But what are the times? It is often, isn't it, when I'm lonely and when I'm depressed, when I'm harassed, when I'm down, when I'm, to use the caricature role model, so don't snipe at me for them afterwards, when the car breaks down and it's laundrette time and all of those sort of issues. Wouldn't it be great if? But when it comes to the decision of how am I going to spend my money? What shall I do tonight? There's sometimes a great advantage in not actually having to worry about someone else. There is a freedom. You see, all I'm really saying is this, and all the apostle, I think, is saying is this. There are tensions for the married person. The married disciple has to live with tensions too. For the apostle, in this whole chapter, he's saying, actually, he's writing about a discipleship issue. Look at verse 35. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order, to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. That's why he's writing. He wants me to be a single-minded disciple for Christ. And he knows that singleness and marriage both have tensions that can stop me being that. And don't let's remove those areas from this arena of discipleship and pretend it's all about another part of living. So as I end, let me try and be very practical and say some things that seem to me to come from this chapter about marriage and singleness and our views of them. Firstly, on marriage, and that is this, the apostle does not have a Mills and Boone view of marriage. You know, the wedding bells chimed and they lived happily ever after. No, there are some hassles involved if you're married. Look at verses 33 and 34. See, the unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. That's precisely where he wants the disciple to be. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. It's not that if you're a Christian you get married, you automatically become worldly only, but your interests are divided. The unmarried woman or girl is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. The married woman is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please her husband. See, you become married and many of the sexual pressures are off. But other pressures come on. I'd want to say, and Claire, I'm sure, would say the same thing, that as a married couple, the challenge of materialism is much, much harder than ever it was when I was single. Not because Claire's materialistic. It's just that there are so many good, valid reasons now why things are needed. Or I've got to think of them. I've got wife and three children to support, you know, all that little line in the begging bowl outside. Well, you may not have the begging bowl, but what if? What if I was run over by the bus? What provision do I make for them? What can I reasonably expect them to live in? What future have they got? And how much do they know of where the future is going? I've got to worry about those things. I can't be caring properly for them without having some concern for them. Marriage is not the place, secondly, for ultimate satisfaction. Look at verse 29. I mean, brethren, the appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. Now, that rather striking verse, I think, is explained by verse 31. The form of this world is passing away. It seems to be what it's leading up to. It's not to say, Hugh, from now on, live as if Claire doesn't exist. At least I hope it's not. At least she hopes it's not. Now, what it's surely telling me is this, isn't it? It's actually saying the form of this world is passing away. And you know, when this world passes away, one of the things that will pass away with it is marriage. There is no marriage in heaven. I'll have my own personality there. Claire will have her own personality there. But somehow or other our relationships are worked out differently in heaven. Now I need to bear that in mind, don't I? Whether I'm married or single, beware of making marriage my be-all and end-all. I mean, if you're married, may you find great joy and happiness and fulfillment in it, but it is not the place where my ultimate security and my ultimate fulfillment and satisfaction is to be found. That's in God and in Jesus Christ. And if I don't keep that priority right, I will put a very unfair burden on my partner. He or she will have to play God to me. And they won't manage it. Now, there's a negatives about marriage. Here seems to me the positive that runs all the way through the chapter. Of course, marriage is the normal, natural place for my sexuality to be expressed. I don't think you can miss that as you read the chapter, can you? Right back to the beginning in verse 2, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. And yet, when he says that it's normal, he doesn't want to imply, and he keeps checking himself to make sure he doesn't want to imply that being single is abnormal. It's the intended place for the gift of sex God has given me. So marrieds don't long to be free. And yet, singleness is a gift too. It's God's blessing and provision, marriage. Yet I cannot look life in the eyes and say I have a divine right to a partner. I may have been given a divine gift to cope single. Well, then God's other gift, singleness. Just two things really to say about that. I can't, if I believe the words of this chapter, look down on those who are single. I know we won't want to. I just want to say that it's very, very easy for us to do it. We've got many subtle ways of doing it. From matchmaking, you know, the Christian matchmakers, they're always pairing people off. The moment we know so-and-so is going out with so-and-so, we're starting to put the pressure on with the, oh, when are you going to announce the engagement? It does put great pressure on people, doesn't it? It does actually put people off in a church circle from ever going out with someone until they're sure they're going to marry them, which means actually from ever going out with someone. It's quite difficult to be sure till you've met. From consoling our single friend with the, don't worry, I know someone who got married when they were 25, 35, 45, whatever age you've got to sort of think one up at. See, it's all implying, isn't it? Dear, 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 there is something wrong with you, but don't worry, it might work out okay in the end. Couples, those of us who are married, this huge danger we keep on falling into of actually forgetting our single friends and leaving them behind once we're married. It's very natural. You come together as a twosome, and of course your affinity is instantly with other twosomes. And the single friend just somehow or other stops being invited so frequently round. Forgive us if we abuse those of you who babysit for us. It's one of the ways in which you're helping us with the pressures of being married. And if we just treat you as a babysitter and ignore you and don't in any sense bring you into the family and treat you as a person in your own right, then we're looking down on you, and I'm sorry. I want to say that in some of our subtle ways of putting the squeeze on the single people, we actually enhance the view that often comes to a single person where they have a low self-esteem. They feel they're on the shelf, to use the horrible expression. And indeed, the very names we call them, particularly the girls, just simply does it, doesn't it? Spinster. I mean, I can remember when we were teenagers delighting in telling my sister she was a spinster. A bachelor is a safe position to do that from, isn't it? Isn't it remarkable what different connotations the words have? Someone told me a bachelor is someone who's not made the same mistake once. And you never make that joke about a spinster. Friends, singleness cannot have a low value if it is a special gift from God. But if you're single, then this chapter is also constantly saying to you not only May it be that at least for the moment that is your special gift from God, but you're not bound to stay single. And there is nothing extra spiritual in doing so. Look at verse 35. He's put the advantages, so to speak, for the disciple about being single. He's not got torn loyalties. And look how he puts it. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you. Now, what restraint is he thinking of? I don't want to give you the impression that you've got to be single to be a good disciple, isn't it? I don't want you to feel that marriage is inferior or out. I don't want in any way to close the door to marriage to you. I do long that you have undivided devotion to the Lord. Well, there we are. The issue, sexual purity. The principle, two ways to cope. Celibacy or marriage. One application, marriage is for sex. The summary, both singleness and marriage, God's special gifts. Let's pray we treat them that way. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for making us the people we are. We ask that you'd help us to face up to ourselves, our instincts and our desires and our drives. We pray that by your special gifts, you'd give us grace to live pure lives and to be true disciples of yours. For Jesus' sake. Amen.